This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Vanderbeekers of 141st Street by Karina Jan Glaser, narrated by Robin Miles. Friday, December 20th. Chapter 1. In the middle of a quiet block on 141st Street, inside a brownstone made of deep red shale, the Vanderbeeker family gathered in the living room for a family meeting. Their pets, a dog named Franz, a cat named George Washington, and a house rabbit named Paganini, sprawled on the carpet, taking afternoon naps in a strip of sunlight. The pipes rumbled companionably within the brownstone walls. "Do you want the good news or the bad news first?" The five Vanderbeeker kids looked at their parents. "Good news," said Issa and Lainey. "Bad news," said Jesse, Oliver, and Hyacinth.
"Righto," said Papa. "Good news first."
He paused and adjusted his glasses.
"You kids all know how much Mama and I love you, right?"
Oliver, who was 9 years old and wise to the ways of the world, put down his book and squinted.
"Are you guys getting divorced? Jimmy L's parents got a divorce, then they let him get a pet snake."
He kicked the backs of his sneakers against the tall stack of ancient encyclopedias he was sitting on.
"No, we're..." Papa began.
"Is it true?"
6-year-old Hyacinth whispered, tears pooling in her round eyes.
"Of course we're..." Mama said.
"What's a divorce?"
interrupted Lainey, who was 4 3/4 years old and practicing her forward rolls on the carpet. She was wearing an outfit of red plaids, lavender stripes, and aqua polka dots that she had matched herself.
"It means Mom and Papa don't love each other anymore," said 12-year-old Jessie, glaring at her parents from behind chunky black eyeglasses.
"What a nightmare!"
"We'll have to split our time between them," added Issa, Jessie's twin.
She was holding her violin and jabbed her bow against the arm of the couch.
"Alternating holidays and summers and whatnot. I think I'm going to be sick."
Mama threw up her hands.
"Stop! Just everyone, please, stop! Papa and I are not getting a divorce. Absolutely not.
We're going about this all wrong."
Mama glanced at Papa, took a deep breath, and briefly closed her eyes. Issa noticed dark circles under her mom's eyes that hadn't been there the week before.
Mama's eyes opened. "Let's start over. First, answer this question. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you like living here?"
The Vanderbeeker kids glanced around at their home, a brownstone in Harlem, New York City. It consisted of the basement, a ground floor with a living room that flowed into an open kitchen, a bathroom, and a laundry room, and a first floor with 3 bedrooms, a walk-in closet-turned-bedroom where Oliver lived, and another bathroom, all lined up in a row. A door on the ground floor opened up to a skinny backyard, where a mommy cat and her new litter of kittens made their home under a hydrangea bush. The kids considered Mama's question.
10, Jesse, Issa, Hyacinth, and Lainey replied. 1,000,000, said Oliver, still squinting suspiciously at his parents.
"It's the best place in the world," reported Lainey, who somersaulted again and knocked down Issa's music stand.
The pets scattered except Franz, who didn't flinch despite now being covered in sheet music.
"We've lived here most of our lives," said Issa. "It's the perfect home."
"Except the Biedermann, of course," added Jesse.
The Biedermann lived on the brownstone's 3rd floor. He was a seriously unpleasant man. He was also their landlord.
"Mr. Biedermann," Papa corrected Jesse.
"And funny you mention him."
Papa stood up and started pacing the length of the couch. His face was so grim that his ever-present smile creases disappeared.
"I didn't see this coming, but Mr. Biedermann just told me he's not renewing our lease."
"He's not renewing our..." Jesse started. "What a punk!" shouted Oliver.
"What's a lease?"
asked Lainey. Papa continued as if the kids hadn't spoken.
"Now, you all have done a great job this past year, respecting Mr. Biederman and his need for privacy and quiet," he said. "I mean, I thought for sure he would have kicked us out a couple of years ago when Oliver hit that baseball through his window, or when Franz used his front door like a fire hydrant. I'm surprised he's making us leave now, after a spotless record this year."
Papa paused and peered at his children. The kids nodded and looked back at him with innocent eyes, all except Oliver, who was hoping no one remembered the little incident earlier that year when his frisbee snapped a sprinkler pipe, causing a blast of water to shoot right into the Biederman's open window. Papa did not bring up the sprinkler incident. Instead, he said, "We have to move at the end of the month." The room exploded with indignation.
"Are you serious? We've been so good, there might as well be halos above our heads," exclaimed Jessie, her glasses slipping down the bridge of her nose.
"I haven't bounced a basketball in front of the building in months," Oliver said.
"What's a lease?"
Lainey asked again.
"Isa has to practice violin in the freaking dungeon," said Jessie.
"Language," Mama warned. At the same time, Isa said, "I like practicing down there."
Papa looked at Lainey.
"We have a lease with Mr. Biederman. It's an agreement between us for living here."
Lainey considered what Papa said as she prepped another somersault.
"So that means he doesn't want us?"
"It's not that," Mama trailed off.
"I think the Biederman needs hugs," Lainey decided.
She completed an accident-free somersault, then rolled over to lie on her stomach, searching for her bunny, who had taken refuge under the couch. Jessie glanced at the calendar on the wall.
"So that's it? We've only got 11 days left here?"
"He's really going to make us move right after Christmas?" asked Isa.
"Is it because I can't keep Franz quiet?" asked Hyacinth as she chewed her fingernails.
When Franz heard Hyacinth say his name, his tail gave a little wag, and his eyes fluttered open, then drifted closed again.
"I think it's my fault," Isa said.
Her siblings stared at her. No one could imagine perfect Isa ever being the cause of getting kicked out of their home.
"You know, because of my violin playing."
"Kids, it's no one's fault," Mama interjected. "Remember how Papa and Uncle Arthur installed those energy-saving windows last year? Those windows are much more soundproof than the old ones. We've done all we can to try to persuade Mr. Biederman to let us stay. I even left a box of lavender macarons outside his door."
Mama blinked rapidly. As a professional pastry chef, she took macarons very seriously.
"What a waste," grumbled Oliver,
who also took macarons very seriously.
"Will our new place have a basement so I can practice?" Isa asked.
"I'm only moving if I can have a science lab in the new place with a Bunsen burner and new Erlenmeyer flasks," Jessie said stubbornly.
"My room's gonna look exactly the same, right? Like, exactly?" asked Oliver.
"Will we move close by so Franz can keep all his doggy friends?" asked Hyacinth.
At Hyacinth's comment, the other kids' eyes widened. They'd never considered that they might have to leave the neighborhood where they knew everyone on the block by name, age, and hairstyle.
"I've lived in this neighborhood my whole life," Papa said. "My job is here."
Only Hyacinth noticed that he didn't answer her question or look anyone in the eye when he said that.
"Listen, kids, I have to fix the wobbly banister on the second floor and then take the building trash out, but we're not done talking about this, okay?"
Papa took his worn blue coveralls off the coat hanger and pulled them over the work clothes he was wearing for his computer repair job. The coveralls looked like something an auto mechanic would wear. Papa observed the somber faces of his kids.
"I'm really sorry about this. I know you love this place, but I promise this will turn out okay.
He slipped out the door.
The kids hated when their parents talked about things turning out okay. How could they know?
Before the kids could start in with the questions again, Mama's cell phone pinged. She glanced at the caller, then back at the kids.
I have to get this, but don't worry, we'll talk about it more, I promise.
The kids watched her rush up the stairs, then heard her say,
Yes, Mrs. Mitchell, thank you for calling. We're very interested in that apartment you listed,
followed by her bedroom door shutting.
Move, said Oliver, breaking the silence.
That's bananas.
Rotten Biederman.
I can't imagine not living here,
Issa said, her fingers running over her violin strings.
I really hope it wasn't my violin playing that caused all this.
Issa had discovered Mr. Biederman's particular distaste for instruments 6 years ago, when she was in first grade. She was performing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star on her tiny 1/8-sized instrument for their second-floor neighbor, Miss Josie. Issa stood outside Miss Josie's apartment. But halfway through her song, Mr. Biederman's door on the third floor burst open. He yelled down the staircase for the terrible racket to stop, or he would call the police. Then the door slammed.
The police? On a 6-year-old violinist?
Issa was in tears, and Miss Josie invited her in and fed her cookies from a delicate china dish and gave her a pretty lace handkerchief to dry her eyes. Then Miss Josie insisted that Issa keep the handkerchief, which Issa, to this day, stowed in her violin case.
It makes no sense,
said Jessie, pacing back and forth between the couch and the picture window. She ran her hands through her wild hair, which made her look like a crazed scientist.
Newton's third law says that for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. Now consider this. Papa does so much for the building. He keeps the front stoop clean, he rakes leaves, he shovels snow. He saves the Biederman so much money by doing all the repairs himself. So what about Newton's third law? The Biederman kicking us out of the building is not an equal reaction.
I want to see a Newton, exclaimed Lainey.
I don't think that law applies here, said Issa, unconsciously adjusting her neat ponytail into an even neater ponytail.
Newton's laws apply to everything, Jessie said with her, I'm right, and no one can convince me otherwise voice. Uncle Arthur helps with the big repairs, Oliver commented, as he searched through the stack of ancient encyclopedias for the one marked with an N.
Papa does all the daily stuff, Jessie pointed out, and he fixes Uncle Arthur's laptop whenever it breaks.
Oliver pulled the correct encyclopedia from the stack and flipped through it.
Newton is this guy, he said to Lainey, pointing to a photo in the book.
He has very nice hair, said Lainey, running her fingers over the picture.
Don't read that, scolded Jessie. Those books are 60 years old and full of inaccurate science.
Okay, people, Issa interrupted. Let's get back on topic. I figure we have until Christmas to convince the Biederman to let us stay.
That's only 4.5 days, Jessie exclaimed.
She looked at her watch.
106 hours.
Exactly. Less than 5 days, people. Who has ideas?
Give him lots of hugs, suggested Lainey.
Oliver rubbed his hands together and raised one eyebrow.
Let's spray paint his door.
He gave a dramatic pause. With disgusting bathroom words. Issa ignored her brother.
Lainey, I think you're right. We should try to do nice things for the Biederman. You know, change his mind about us.
Jessie and Oliver looked skeptical. Hyacinth looked scared. Lainey looked ready to give out hugs. After a long silence, Oliver shrugged.
I'd be willing to do nice things for him, if he lets us stay.
I guess I can try to be nice to him, Jessie said.
Issa gave her a grateful look.
Although if this doesn't work, Oliver and I totally get to spray paint his door.
What do you think, Hyacinth?
He scares me,
Hyacinth said, chewing at her pinky finger.
It's 5-1, said Oliver. What could he do to us anyway?
I know you can do this, Issa said to Hyacinth. You need to channel Hyacinth the Brave.
Hyacinth nodded, but continued gnawing on her pinky.
Issa mused. Wouldn't it be great if we were able to convince the Biedermen to let us stay? It would be like giving Mama and Papa the most amazing Christmas present ever.
The Vanderbeeker kids thought about giving their parents the best Christmas present ever. Of course, Hyacinth had already made presents for them. She had completed them 2 months ago, but she liked the idea of a group gift. Oliver, who had spent quite a bit of time contemplating what he was going to get for Christmas, just remembered he was expected to give gifts as well.
Mama and Papa deserve an amazing present from us, Oliver decided. Let's keep it a secret.
Issa looked at him.
You haven't gotten them anything yet, have you?
Oliver quickly changed the topic.
If it's a secret, we need to make sure you know who doesn't spill the beans.
He gave a not-so-discreet nod toward Lainey. Lainey,
this is a secret, instructed Jesse.
Right, Lainey agreed promptly.
Right what? Jesse said.
Right. Let's be nice to Beaker Mac, Lainey said.
Yes, but we're going to keep it a secret from Mama and Papa. Right, Lainey?
Jesse prompted.
Right!
The five kids started exchanging ideas for winning over the man on the third floor. Operation Biederman had officially begun. They tried to feel hopeful about their plan, but in the back of each of their minds, they were all thinking the same thing. How do you make friends with a man you've never seen and who has not left his apartment in 6 years?
Chapter 2
The northern side of 141st Street was buffered by brownstones standing shoulder to shoulder, as if marching in formation. The buildings were all about the same height, with a ground floor called the garden level, and three more floors rising above. Some brownstones, like the one the Vanderbeekers lived in, also had a basement, which Jesse referred to as the dungeon. Although all the brownstones on the narrow, tree-lined street were the same size, each one had its own personality. One brownstone was rotund, like a jolly, well-fed grandfather with a curved facade and decorative curlicues above round, owlish windows. A few skips down stood a perfectly symmetrical brownstone with a more regal disposition, which stood in direct contrast to its frivolous neighbor, a brownstone with flashy turrets and multicolored shingles that sparkled on sunny days. On the southern side of the street were a mix of larger apartment buildings, and at either end of the block were churches that had recently celebrated their centennials. Next to one of the churches sat a narrow piece of abandoned land, which Miss Josie always talked about making into a community garden, and Oliver wanted converted into a basketball court. Two blocks to the west was a thin sliver of a park built into a rocky hill. At the top of the hill was a series of castle-like structures that made up the City College of New York's Harlem campus. The sidewalks of 141st Street were wide, but the street was narrow. Majestic street lamps were staggered on both sides of the sidewalk, spaced 50 paces apart. The posts stretched past the first floor of the brownstone, then curved over like a crashing wave. In the evening, the warm glow of the lights made passers-by feel that this street might have looked the same 100 years earlier. The Vanderbeekers' home, a humble red brownstone with a weather vane that spun on windy days, sat in the exact middle of the street. The brownstone stood out not because of its architecture, but because of the constant hum of activity that burst out of it. Among the many people who had visited the Vanderbeeker household, there was quite a bit of debate about what it was like, but general agreement about what it was not. Calm, tidy, boring, predictable. At the moment, the things the Vanderbeeker household were not
seemed more pronounced than usual. The kids had relocated their Biederman meeting to Jesse and Issa's bedroom upstairs, where the ancient radiator whistled cheerfully at their arrival. Issa pulled out the easel and stood ready to jot notes, marker in hand. Hyacinth was making Operation Biederman buttons for the kids to wear for their brainstorming sessions. Lainey had discovered a box of flower clips under Issa's bed and was attaching each one to her ponytail. As the kids settled in, Issa looked out at her siblings. As a biracial family, the kids exhibited an eclectic mix of physical characteristics and loved comparing which traits they got from what parent. Issa inherited her mother's stick-straight black hair, which Issa always wore in a sleek ponytail or an elegant French braid, while her twin Jessie had Papa's wild, untamable hair, which she never bothered to do anything with. Oliver had Papa's unruly hair, but Mama's dark eyes. Hyacinth got Mama's nimble fingers, but Papa's large feet. Lainey was an exact blend of both of her parents. Her hair was a shade of dark brown you would get if you swirled her parents' hair colors together on an artist's palette, her feet not small or large, and her eyes were darker than her Papa's, but lighter than her Mama's. Issa cleared her throat and tapped her marker on the easel. After the room quieted down and she called their meeting to order, she made the first Operation Biederman suggestions.
"We could sing Christmas carols to him," she suggested. "You know, bring him a little Christmas spirit."
"What if he's Jewish? Would Christmas carols offend him?" asked Jessie from her spot by the radiator.
"We could sing Christmas and Hanukkah songs," said Issa.
"I have a little dreidel, I made it out of clay," sang Lainey, off-key and very loud.
Her head looked like a garden with the flower clips attached all over it. Oliver stuck fingers in his ears and winced.
"That is just really, really bad."
"Maybe no dreidel songs," Issa said as Lainey continued chanting, "Dreidel, dreidel, dreidel, I made it out of clay."
"I have a feeling he won't want us singing to him," said Jessie, glancing at Lainey.
"I don't know. It's just a hunch." "Dreidel, dreidel, dreidel," Lainey sang.
Issa put a hand over Lainey's mouth to muffle her singing.
"How about doing something to help around the building? Like planting flowers or something. Miss Josie can help. She's great with flowers."
"It's winter. Flowers aren't going to grow now," Jessie said matter-of-factly.
"How about poinsettias? That's a holiday-ish flower," said Issa.
Hyacinth wrapped protective arms around Franz, who was sitting at her feet, and glared at Issa.
"Poinsettias are poisonous to animals."
"What about wreaths?" Issa said.
"Too expensive," said Oliver.
Jessie huffed in frustration.
"Okay, I see multiple problems."
She ticked them off on her fingers.
"One, he doesn't like us. Two, we have no money. Three, none of us has actually seen or met the Biederman, and we know nothing about him. Four, he doesn't want to be disturbed. Five, he doesn't like us."
"That's the thing," said Issa. "I'm sure there's a way to show him that us living here is better than us not living here."
"Yeah, but how?" Jessie asked. "The only person we've ever seen go up there is the bird lady who drops off groceries once a week."
The bird lady was aptly nicknamed. She resembled a crane with her long, skinny legs and pointy beak nose. Oliver shook his head.
"She won't be any help. I said hi to her a few times, and she walked past me like I wasn't even there. But I did peek into a grocery bag she left downstairs once. It was filled with frozen dinners."
"Yuck," said Hyacinth.
Jessie moved to her desk and switched on the computer she shared with Issa.
"I'm going to see if I can find something out about him online."
She tapped some keys, paused, then tapped more keys.
"That's weird. I can't get online."
Oliver, who was used to the internet shutting off at inconvenient times, jumped up.
"I'll reset it."
His sisters heard him run down the hall, then some murmuring, then his feet stomping back to the twins' bedroom.
"Internet is shut off," Oliver announced with a scowl on his face. "Mama said they had to disconnect it today or pay for the whole next month plus a contract renewal fee."
"Oh, great," Jesse said. "That's just perfect."
Issa sensed discontent brewing in the room.
"Maybe we need some time to get our best ideas together."
She capped her marker and shoved the blank easel back to the corner of the room. Issa stood up straight and tried to make her voice sound positive and cheerful.
"Let's meet again after dinner. Everyone bring at least 2 awesome ideas. I know we can do it."
Her siblings exchanged a look as they left the bedroom.
When Issa did that falsely cheery voice thing, it meant she was worried. Very worried.
The Vanderbeeker kids spent the next few hours agonizing over the Biederman dilemma. How could they convince him to change his mind? After all, it was only 5 days until Christmas. Oliver had dark thoughts about the Biederman as he banged down the stairs, grabbed his puffy jacket, and stepped out into the backyard. It was a space eclipsed by a century-old maple tree that dropped mountains of leaves every year from October to December. Oliver leaped onto the rope swing hanging from one of the many branches. He climbed up the rope so his feet rested on the fat knot at the bottom, and he got the rope swaying. As he gained momentum and height, he closed his eyes and breathed in the crisp, cold air. He could almost smell the salty ocean wind. For that moment, he was hanging from the ropes of a pirate ship, racing across seas to confront and challenge the evil Biederman, a peg-legged man with a long scar on his right cheek who was intent on destruction and mayhem. In the midst of a nasty gale, he heard Jimmy L. yelling at him. Oliver opened his eyes and looked over at the brownstone across the yard, where his friend was waving from his bedroom window on the second floor. Oliver waited for the rope to steady, then ascended the rope Navy SEAL style by locking it between his feet and squatting and stepping all the way up to the top. He had learned this technique from his PE teacher, Mr. Mendoza, the most awesome human being ever to walk on the planet, who used to be a Navy SEAL himself and now challenged each of his students to climb a rope as fast as he could. The top of the rope led to the start of the tree plank Uncle Arthur had made for him last year. Papa was hopeless with larger scale construction projects and big repairs, so Uncle Arthur usually did those things for him. Oliver hopped onto the sun-warmed plank. He scared off a squirrel that was sitting on the lid of the wooden bin that held all his stuff. Then he opened the lid and rummaged through the contents. There was a pack of spare batteries, a flashlight, a handful of granola bars, a first aid kit, his Uncle Arthur insisted, and 2 bottles of orange Fanta that Oliver had to hide from his mother. At last he found what he was looking for, the walkie-talkie he shared with Jimmy L. The walkie-talkies were very useful, since neither his nor Jimmy L's parents let them have cell phones. Oliver clicked the walkie-talkie on, and the radio buzzed to life. Oliver heard static, then Jimmy L's voice came through the device.
"Captain Kidd, come in, over."
"Magic J, this is Captain Kidd," Oliver responded.
Magic J, Jimmy L's secret agent name, was riffed from his favorite basketball player, the legendary Magic Johnson. Captain Kidd was taken from the notorious pirate. Oliver heard Jimmy L. sigh through the walkie-talkie.
"Captain Kidd, you need to say go ahead."
"Oh, yeah, sorry. Magic J, go ahead."
"All quiet here, over."
"Potential disastrous situation here at 177 West 141 Street, Oliver said. "Immediate attention required. How copy?"
"Captain Kidd, I copy that. Elaborate. Over."
"The Biederman, you know, our landlord. He's forcing us to move. We have to leave by the end of the month. Over."
There was a long pause. Oliver pressed the button to talk again. Magic J, radio check. Over. Jimmy L's voice came through the device, loud enough to make the squirrel that was attempting a granola bar theft scurry away.
Are you serious, Oliver?
Oliver grimaced. Jimmy L had broken conversation protocol, which had never happened before in the history of their walkie-talkie relationship.
Yeah, my parents just told us, Oliver said into his device.
This is the neighbor dude who yelled at your dad when we hit the baseball into his window?
That's the one, Oliver replied.
That's so wrong, man. He can't take away your home.
He's doing it. Papa says we're staying in the neighborhood, though.
What about the treehouse? What about our walkie-talkies, man? We saved up for 2 months for these things.
We're trying to convince the Biederman to let us stay, Oliver said lamely. That head-squeezing feeling he had felt back when his parents first told him the news had returned.
Let me know what happens, man. I can help you. Over.
Jimmy L was back to the walkie-talkie protocol, which Oliver took as a good sign.
Thanks. We on for basketball on Sunday? Over.
Yeah, man. Current ETA for basketball game on Sunday is 1,400 hours.
How copy?
Magic J, I copy that. Over.
And Oliver?
Yeah?
I really don't want you to move.
Oliver looked over at Jimmy L's window, but his friend had disappeared from view. The sun dropped behind a building, and a shadow fell across the treehouse.
Magic J, I read you loud and clear. Over.
Chapter 3. Hyacinth always had her best ideas when surrounded by her favorite things. Scraps of odd-shaped fabric, buttons of many shapes, fat spools of thread in a rainbow of colors, and paper packets with deadly-looking sewing needles. Hyacinth's yellow paisley dress, her own creation, was made from an old pillowcase with holes cut out for her arms and head. She knotted a wide lavender ribbon around her waist to complete the look. Sitting in the middle of the living room, Hyacinth rummaged through her ribbon collection as she tried to think of something to make for the Biederman. It would have to be something so spectacular that he would change his mind about forcing them to move. When Franz ambled by, Hyacinth took out a piece of green ribbon and draped it over him. His tail wagged, about a 200 on the WPM, or wags per minute, meter. Out of the corner of her eye, Hyacinth spotted her mom leave the kitchen, disappear into the laundry room, then reappear, lugging a stack of collapsed boxes that had been stored behind the washing machine. But they weren't just regular boxes. They were moving boxes. Hyacinth's bleak mood was interrupted by Franz's happy yell, followed by the sound of the mail slot opening and a stack of envelopes and magazines dropping onto the floor. Hyacinth hopped to her feet and followed Franz to the front door. She rotated the locks and pulled the door open.
"Hello, Mr. Jones," said Hyacinth.
Mr. Jones had been a postman in her neighborhood since before Papa was born. Franz barked twice and snuffled his nose into the mailbag.
"My friends," Mr. Jones replied, rubbing Franz behind the ears with one hand and giving Hyacinth a high five with the other.
He gently nudged Franz's nose out of the way, then took a biscuit from his mailbag and tossed it to him. Franz swallowed it whole and shamelessly rummaged through the mailbag for more. Mr. Jones was dressed in his usual navy blue parka with the USPS Sonic Eagle logo, blue pants, black slip-resistant shoes. Mama had bought those for him after Mr. Jones slipped on a patch of ice last winter and sprained his wrist, and a fur cap, also with the Sonic Eagle logo. Mr. Jones wore a few accessories not sanctioned by the USPS. These were round buttons designed by Hyacinth with help from her button machine. One said, "Mail rules." Another said, "Love your postman." And the last said, "Dogs are a postman's best friend." The dog one was the hardest to read, given the amount of text squeezed onto the tiny circle.
"And how are we doing today, Miss Hyacinth?"
Mr. Jones said.
"We are fine, thank you,"
Hyacinth said in her most polite voice.
"Isn't that so nice to hear?"
Mr. Jones said as he took out a handkerchief and polished the three buttons attached to his parka.
"Very nice to hear indeed."
Hyacinth picked up a small bag of bone-shaped dog treats from the table next to the door and handed them to Mr. Jones.
"These are peanut butter dog treats," Hyacinth said. "If you haven't visited Senor Paz yet, I think he would like them."
Senor Paz was an ancient black chihuahua that lived down the street.
"I'm sure Senor Paz will right appreciate these,"
Mr. Jones replied, tucking the bag carefully into his pocket. He said sure, the same way Hyacinth said sure.
"As a matter of fact," he continued, "I'm heading that way next. Tell me now, did you make these by yourself?"
"Yes, I did,"
Hyacinth replied, glad he asked. She normally did not offer up this type of information, in case it was considered bragging.
"Mama helped, of course."
"Your mama sure does have a hand with the bacon,"
Mr. Jones said with an agreeable nod.
"I don't know what the neighborhood dogs would do without you, Miss Hyacinth. I thought Snuggles had gone to heaven when he tasted the other dog cookie you made."
Thinking about Snuggles made Hyacinth think about her blanket, also named Snuggles, which made her think of her bed and bedroom, which reminded her of the move.
"Oh, Mr. Jones, Mama and Papa told us the worst news ever today. We're moving."
She pulled at the hems of her shirt sleeves and balled the ends into her fists. Mr. Jones's body appeared to shrink a few inches.
"Move? What move?"
At that exact moment, Mama skidded into the foyer holding a bag.
"Hello," she said with a big, apologetic smile.
"Hello, Mr. Jones. I baked some cookies. Would you like some?"
"Nothing like double chocolate pecan cookies to comfort the tummy and the soul, I always say."
Mr. Jones did not reach out for the bag.
"Now tell me straight, Mrs. Vanderbeke, are you moving?"
Hyacinth noticed that Mama also seemed to shrink a little bit.
"Oh, Mr. Jones, I was hoping to tell you first. Our landlord isn't renewing our lease. We just found out."
"I've known your husband since he was born,"
Mr. Jones said, accusation in his eyes.
"I know, Mr. Jones. You're like a part of our family,"
Mama said, tears coming into her eyes as she nudged Franz's nose out of a mail bag and tucked the bag of double chocolate pecan cookies in there instead.
"We're looking for another place in the neighborhood, Mr. Jones. If you hear of anything, please let us know," Mama said.
Mr. Jones went quiet for a few seconds, then said,
"Mr. Biederman is your landlord?"
Hyacinth and Mama nodded. Mr. Jones shook his head and glanced up, as if he expected to see Mr. Biederman hanging out his third-floor window at that exact moment.
"Mr. Biederman had some hard times,"
Mr. Jones said, looking back at them.
"Hard times? He bought this brownstone a few months before your family moved in. He used to live a couple blocks away, right by the college. He worked there."
"You knew Mr. Biederman? What did he do?"
Hyacinth asked.
"He taught in the art history department."
"He made paintings?"
"He studied art and its history. Who made the art, where and when the artists lived, what techniques they used. Then he taught students about it,"
Mr. Jones said, giving Franz a final head pat.
"Well, I best be going. Lots of mail to deliver."
Mr. Jones held up the bag Hyacinth had given him.
"And dog treats to pass out. Have a good day now."
He tipped his fur cap and leaned slightly on the bar of his postage cart as he rolled it away from the Vanderbeke brownstone and down the street. Mama reached over Hyacinth's head and clicked the door closed, then shuffled back to the kitchen to cook dinner, while Hyacinth watched out the window until she couldn't see Mr. Jones anymore. Lainey, the youngest Vanderbeeker, had transformed into her alter ego, Panda Lainey. A furry white coat was draped over her stout body, and she was crawling around, keeping her mama company in the kitchen. She was the only one who was not so concerned about the possibility of moving. If the Biederman was the only obstacle, Lainey knew she could win him over. She loved people. Surely he would love her, too. So instead of thinking about ideas to save their home like Issa had asked, Lainey put all her attention on getting double chocolate pecan cookies from Mama. On occasion, she pawed at Mama's feet and was rewarded with a carrot. Lainey didn't like carrots so much, too crunchy and too orange. But Panda Lainey loved them. Panda Lainey also loved cookies. Well, Lainey liked them too. And if she was lucky and ate three whole carrots, usually a cookie would follow. Panda Lainey peered around the kitchen island. She spied Paganini, her lop-eared bunny, under the couch.
"Paganini,"
Panda Lainey said in a loud whisper. One bunny ear twitched, and Paganini's nose moved up and down like a motor. The gray rabbit scooted out from under the couch, and after a suspicious glance in Franz's direction, hopped toward Panda Lainey's outstretched hand. Paganini loved it when Panda Lainey came out to play, because that meant carrots. After grabbing the carrot, Paganini dragged it back under the couch and devoured his prize. Panda Lainey ate the other two carrots with less enthusiasm, then crawled back to her mom's heels and looked up. "Okay, you little beggar," Mama said with a smile. "Just one cookie, and bring one to your sister." Her mom passed her two cookies. Panda Lainey inspected both with a critical eye. One was a little bit larger, but the other was shaped like Paganini. Panda Lainey debated between them before choosing the larger one and giving the Paganini-shaped cookie to Hyacinth, who crammed it in her mouth and mumbled a gloomy, "Thanks," without bothering to look up from her ribbons. Jessie, wearing jeans and a baggy navy hoodie, was perched on the steps leading to the dungeon with a pile of colored gumdrops and wooden toothpicks in neat piles around her. She was constructing model molecules by connecting colored gumdrops that were supposed to represent atoms, but she got distracted, pretending the gumdrops were the Biederman's eyes, and she was stabbing them with the toothpicks. Issa was down in the basement, positioned at the bottom of the stairs so she could see Jessie. Her violin was cradled on her shoulder, and she was zipping through various etudes, short study pieces her music teacher insisted she practice every day. When she finished, she gazed up at Jessie. "So, do you have any ideas for saving our home yet?" asked Issa. Jessie scowled. "Does it look like I have any ideas? Can't you tell I'm in the anger stage of grief?"
"Jess, you've got to pull it together. We need your problem-solving brains."
Jessie put down her toothpicks and looked down the stairs.
"Sorry. I'll totally have ideas when we meet up later."
Mama walked by and ruffled Jessie's already disheveled hair.
"Ideas for what?" she asked.
"Ideas for..."
Jessie trailed off and looked down at Issa in alarm.
"Christmas Eve dinner,"
Issa lied.
"I'm so glad you girls are taking care of that," Mama said briskly. "And don't worry about what everyone has been saying. I'm sure it will be great. Why don't you look up some recipes online? I saw this one recipe for shredded Brussels sprouts with maple hickory nuts that maybe you want to try."
Mama passed Jessie her smartphone. "It's bookmarked under recipes." Issa shuddered at the thought of Brussels sprouts, shredded or not, and Jessie made a face at the complexity of the recipe. The twins had been responsible for preparing the family meal on Tuesdays since they turned 12 earlier that year. This year, Christmas Eve fell on a Tuesday, and in the Vanderbeeker tradition, Christmas Eve dinner rivaled Thanksgiving dinner in scope and quality. Oliver, not a huge believer in the twins' cooking abilities, suggested that Jesse and Issa have immunity on Christmas Eve, or perhaps that they trade for a different, less important day. Hyacinth agreed with Oliver's suggestion, and even Papa seemed inclined to think this was a good idea. The twins, offended by the little faith of their so-called family, insisted on keeping to the schedule and vowed to prove themselves. That is, until they received the news about moving. "It's going to be the worst Christmas Eve dinner if we have to move," grumbled Issa. "Any ideas for what we should make? And not that Brussels sprouts thing," Jesse added. Issa paused. "Anything but turkey. I'm still recovering from Thanksgiving. I will throw up." "Okay, how about this?" Jesse set aside the octane gumdrop molecule she had started on and grabbed a piece of paper and a pen. She settled back down on the top step. "We could do roasted vegetables for the side dish. We've never messed those up before." At Issa's nod, Jesse wrote, "Roasted vegetables" on the list. "Okay. Main dish. What about beef stew? How hard could that be?" Issa nodded again, and Jesse jotted it down. "And what to conclude the meal with?" Jesse murmured to herself. She opened up the search engine on Mama's smartphone and scrolled through some recipes on the cooking website they like to use. She picked two under the heading, "Easy Dessert Recipes, Sure to Impress Your Guests." "What do you think about strawberry cheesecake and carrot cake?" "Great," Issa said. "Add fresh bread from Castleman's Bakery, too." Issa started a new etude, making a number of mistakes along the way. "Okay." Jesse wrote the final menu on a sheet of paper. The twins went on to the guest list. "Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet, of course," Issa said. "Oh, man, what will they do if we move?" Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet had lived in the apartment above theirs for as long as anyone could remember. Retired, they spent a lot of time with the Vanderbeekers, and Mama and Papa helped them with grocery shopping and keeping track of their doctor's appointments and medicines. "I don't think Lainey and Hyacinth will be able to leave them," Jesse said. "Lainey will latch herself onto Mr. Jeet's leg and refuse to let go." Jesse continued with the guest list, which grew to include the children's favorite relatives, Auntie Harrigan and Uncle Arthur, who lived in Westchester, as well as Issa's music teacher, Mr. Van Houten.
"Wouldn't it be amazing if we could get the Biederman to come?" Issa mused.
"If the Biederman ends up at our dinner table, it will be a Christmas miracle," replied Jesse. Issa shrugged, then began playing Chardash by Vittorio Monti, moving through to the end of the piece and striking the last note with a flourish of her bow. A familiar scuffling was heard outside. The door to the apartment burst open, and in tumbled their dad. Papa took off his coat and hung it up next to the door, then walked across the kitchen to the basement door.
"Brava!" he called down to Issa. "A perfect rendition of Chardash. Excellent emotional interpretation. Amazing dynamics."
"Oh, Papa," Issa rolled her eyes. "That was the worst."
"But each time is new, my little violinist. You've never played it exactly that way, right? The beauty of live music."
He flicked a nickel down the staircase, where it bounced off some steps and landed in Issa's violin case. Then he scooped up Lainey and placed her on top of his shoulders.
"Has anyone seen my Lainey Bean? I've been looking all over for her."
"I'm not Lainey Bean. I'm Panda Lainey,"
the white-swathed wonder called from above.
"Ah, Panda Lainey, my favorite type of panda. Let me see. I don't remember. Are Panda Lainey's ticklish?"
Lainey collapsed in a torrent of giggles, and Papa swung her off his shoulders and to the ground. Lainey wrapped her arms and legs around his left leg and held on for dear life. Papa half-dragged her to where his wife was mixing batter for cheesy bread. The soup pot bubbled on the stove, the fragrant smell of herbs and vegetables drifting through the kitchen.
"Hello, beautiful lady," he said, dropping a kiss next to her ear.
Mama looked him over. Papa still wore his superintendent uniform, an outfit of his own choosing that he insisted on wearing whenever he did building duties.
"On the bright side," Mama said, "if we move, you won't have to wear that jumpsuit anymore."
"For your information," Papa said, both of his index fingers pointing down at his uniform, "these are coveralls. Only the coolest supers wear them."
"I want coveralls, too,"
Lainey said from the ground, where she still hung on to Papa's leg.
"See," Papa said to Mama, "our daughter has excellent taste."
"I just don't see why you can't wear your normal clothes to take out the trash,"
Mama said, pouring the bread batter into two greased loaf pans.
"Honey, I can't wear my computer clothes when I do stuff around the building. The computer clothes don't have the let's get dirty and fix things personality that my coveralls do." Mama sighed.
Papa scanned the living room and took in the funereal atmosphere. Isa played a mournful tune on her violin, and the brownstone was devoid of the bustle and laughter typical of the Vanderbeeker household. His voice lowered.
"They're not taking the move well, are they?"
Mama looked into Papa's eyes. "No matter what happens," she said, touching his cheek. "I'm grateful for the past 6 years here." She paused. "Even if you did have to wear coveralls." Papa's smile didn't change the melancholy in his eyes as he reached up to put his hand over hers.
"Life here couldn't have been better."
Chapter 4. After Oliver's conversation with Jimmy L., he came back inside, swiped 3 of the double chocolate pecan cookies Mama had baked earlier, then retreated to his bedroom for some Biederman brainstorming time. Being the only boy among 4 sisters was not easy, but there was one perk. Oliver was the only one in the family who had a room to himself. Indeed, it was a tiny walk-in closet-turned bedroom, just big enough to hold his loft bed and a narrow desk underneath it. 5 years ago, Uncle Arthur arrived unannounced, wearing a tool belt and armed with a power drill. Uncle Arthur declared that if Oliver was to survive being the only boy among many sisters, he needed 2 things, an imagination and a place of his own to escape to. His uncle proceeded to install bookshelves on every inch of available open wall space in the room, while Papa looked on in wonder at the blur of construction. From that day on, Uncle Arthur sent Oliver books on a monthly basis, books about superheroes and Greek mythology and pirates and space exploration and presidents. Now walking into Oliver's room was like entering a miniature library that someone happened to live in. An hour later, Oliver had done 0 brainstorming. Rather, he was so deep into his book, Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island, that he didn't hear Mama calling him to dinner. He was Jim Hawkins, struggling to board the ship after cutting the anchor loose, only to be confronted by the wicked pirate Israel Hands.
"Oliver!"
his sisters yelled, crashing into his sacred, quiet bedroom. Oliver jumped at the intrusion before realizing that, 1, he was not Jim Hawkins, and 2, he was not on a pirate ship. He lifted the book right in front of his face.
"Leave me alone!"
Lainey bunny-hopped over to Oliver and threw her arms around him.
"I love you, Ollie," she declared, planting 4 wet kisses on his cheek. "Time for dinner."
"Ugh,"
Oliver said, scrubbing his cheek with his sleeve.
"Long John Silver would maroon you for such despicable behavior."
Lainey grabbed Oliver's hand and tried to yank him to his feet, budging him not one bit. She did, however, manage to trip over his left knee and knock down a pile of comic books stacked by his desk. Lainey emerged from the comic book avalanche, still gripping Oliver's hand.
"Come on! dinner time. Mama made cheesy bread.
Oliver's stomach rumbled. The double chocolate pecan cookies he'd eaten an hour earlier, a distant memory. Despite the lure of piracy, he decided that dinner would be a good idea. Together, the Vanderbeeker children clambered down the steps to the kitchen, all talking at once.
Ah, the sound of my graceful children coming down the stairs. Delightful, Papa called from the kitchen.
Mama turned toward her children and pointed a canary-yellow spatula with a glob of meringue cream at them.
Attention! I need this table set. Pronto!
The meringue cream dripped off the spatula and splattered on the floor right next to Franz, who was lurking around the kitchen, hoping for such a miracle. The kids rushed around, banging drawers and dropping utensils. Finally, the table was set, food was placed in the middle, and people were seated. Then Oliver got up because he wanted ice in his water. Then Lainey insisted on rummaging through the silverware drawer for her special soup spoon. When everyone was seated again, the family held hands. Papa said a quick blessing over the food, and dinner began.
So, Oliver said, jumping right into the very topic at the forefront of everyone's minds. I don't know about you, but I'm feeling like we need to see the Biedermann. You know, before we move.
He looked at his parents with his innocent face. Papa glanced at Mama.
He's trying to look innocent. Something's up.
Mama sighed and looked at Oliver. What are you planning to do to that poor man?
What? Nothing. Why is everyone looking at me like that?
Oliver reached over the table and riffled through the slices of cheesy bread, searching for the biggest piece.
I'm just saying. The Biedermann should be a man and show his face to us at least one time before he evicts us. We need an explanation.
It's Mr. Biedermann, and he's not evicting us. He's not renewing our lease,
Mama said. Isa spoke up.
I've always wondered what he looks like. Is he short? Tall? What color hair does he have?
What types of things is he interested in? Jessie chimed in.
Does he like cute little bunnies?
Asked Lainey, bits of cheesy bread escaping from her mouth.
What about Christmas carols? Or do you know if he's Jewish?
Asked Oliver. For that, he got a kick under the table from two different sources. Based on the synchronicity and the force of the kicks, he was pretty sure they came from the twins.
I know absolutely nothing about him, Mama said. You know how private he is.
Every time I've had to go into his apartment, Papa said, he tells me to let myself in with my super key and closes himself into his bedroom until I'm done.
You have a super key? Said Lainey, amazed. Does it have powers? Is it magic?
He means the superintendent key, Oliver said, rolling his eyes.
I think this whole situation is weird, Jessie said, banging her soup spoon on the table. We've lived here for 6 years and haven't seen him once. Then he kicks us out of our home without even getting to know us?
Mr. Jones said he used to work at City College before we moved in,
Hyacinth said. Mama cleared her throat, then said the words no one wanted to hear.
We need to start packing tomorrow.
Around the table, each Vanderbeeker finished dinner, but the food tasted like dust and left them empty and unsatisfied. After clearing the table and loading the dishwasher, the kids headed upstairs as the brownstone creaked mournfully in the silence.
Off to the rep? Asked Isa.
Desperate times call for desperate measures, replied Jessie.
Isa opened her closet door, pulled out an armload of hoodies, and passed them out. While everyone zipped up the thick sweatshirts, Jessie gathered the rep bag, a duffel that was filled with fleece blankets, along with a large 2-liter bottle that used to hold soda water, but was now filled with tap water. With what Oliver believed was superhuman strength, He yanked up the twins' bedroom window, and the kids climbed out onto the fire escape. Issa hitched Lainey on her back and started up the groaning metal stairs to the rep, otherwise known as the roof of epic proportions. There were two ways